Good day, everyone, and welcome to the conference call on education savings accounts. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Inez Felcher, Director of the Task Force on Education and Workforce Development. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on this call. A lot of what I'm going to say is really building on what I know a lot of you have been working on. So thanks for all the work you do, and thanks for taking the time to join us. So I'm just going to go through a few of the points in the state factor that I released and then turn it over for questions. But just as a reminder, there are a couple of our media friends joining us for this call, so this call is on the record when you ask questions. So just letting you guys know. So the good news, I think, to start off with is that I'm coming at this from the perspective that the ESA revolution is happening. And happening really soon. So we have five states, as most of you know, we have five states with education savings accounts. We have the positive Duncan decision just come down the other day in Nevada's program, which is the most promising and the broadest. But over a dozen states have introduced some kind of ESA program. We expect quite a few more to join them in the 2017 session. And I think that from where I'm sitting sort of at ALEC, I see this as a real trend coming up in the states, and I think we really should expect not only more programs but more very broad programs to get through in the next couple years. So I think it's important to now take some time for us to think about how this is going to work both from the parents' perspective and from the supply-side perspective, because what I'd really not like to have happen is we sort of fumble through our way the first couple years because nobody had thought about these kinds of things beforehand. So I think now is really that time to think about how these are actually going to work. And to that end, I don't think very few of the sort of supply side, the providers who would be unbundling education, as we all like to talk about, are sort of aware of this ESA revolution. And so I think that's also going to be a key component going forward is opening up those channels and making sure that entrepreneurs are attracted to these programs. Policy-wise, I think that means it's really important to get really broad programs like Nevada's and increasingly, you know, sort of Arizona's broadening theirs over time. And also some things like lower regulation. When we want to make sure that the regulatory barrier is not too high to keep out sort of mom-and-pop type entrepreneur shops, and at the same time that the reimbursements are high enough to be meaningful in the market. Now, we all know that sort of more money does not equal automatically better education or better results, but I do think it's important that the reimbursements be high enough to be meaningful in this market, right? Just as an example, if it's, you know, a few hundred dollars, an extreme example. It's not going to be, you know, it's going to help people who are on the bubble about exiting the public system, but it's not going to produce the kind of broad-based revolutionary potential that I think ESAs have promised to be. But my paper actually focused more on how parents are going to deal with this kind of Wild West world. So we're going to have to think about how to answer people who will worry about quality control, right? And if our answer is that parents are a better quality control than sort of the public school system as currently constituted, I think we're going to have to be ready to give an answer to the question, how are parents going to sort through education providers? How are they going to be able to control or to be aware of the quality and the comparative value of different educational providers? So my paper focuses on three potential tools that they'll use, some of which we see already in the education savings accounts programs that are in place, and some of which I sort of stole from other markets, right, especially other education markets, higher education, the homeschooling community, 1.8 million kids who are already, their parents are putting together customized educations for them, and they're sorting through hundreds or perhaps thousands of providers to do it. So I think they're a really great sort of tools and ideas for how this will actually happen. So one of the first things I focused on was consumer reviews. So this is 2016. Everybody is familiar with consumer reviews. On Yelp, even the particular McDonald's down the street from me, from where I live, has like 12 or 15 reviews or something like that. And that's, you know, supposed to be standardized, right? So everything gets reviewed on Amazon, on Angie's List. And the great news about that is I think parents are really familiar with reviewing providers in other contexts, right? So I don't think that people in 2016 need to be, like, encouraged in any way to do this kind of online review. I think they're already doing it. And we see that in Arizona already. There is a message board where parents swap stories about providers and their experience with different education providers. So homeschoolers, like I said, are already there. Not only do they have individual reviews, but they've actually created sort of a market of blogs so that not only can parents go to sort of a more general review site and read testimonials about that education provider, but that market has actually segmented itself into sort of particularized types of reviews. So, for example, Kathy Duffy she's been reviewing homeschool curricula, and materials also, since 1985. So she's been doing this forever. Before it was a blog, I assume before that it was some kind of message board. But so she's been doing this forever, and she breaks it down with sort of key components. You know, what's the religious perspective, if there is one, what grade level, what materials do you need, how much parent involvement or time is required, those kinds of categories. But I think what's really great about this is because we already know that parents talk to each other on their block, and that experience of actual other parents is among the most important factors in their decision-making about where to send their child to get an education. This is kind of moving that to a much broader audience, right? So not only I may not have the same educational perspective as my neighbor, but that might be the only sort of access I have to a review. So I might go with, for example, the education that my neighbor has chosen for her child. And the great thing about moving this all into the internet age is that you can actually select people who have similar values to you. And so I think a lot of those review sites will be focused around a particular sort of type of education, not only religious perspective, but all kinds of things like, you know, the particular learning style or the particular method. Like one, you know, will be all providers that have to do with a particular teaching style or something like that. So I think that's kind of the leap forward will be parents having access not just to their immediate neighbors to talk about schools in their neighborhood, but to parents all over the country who are looking for the same type of educational experience that they are. So second, I talk about branding. This one's really obvious to anybody from any other market, but for some reason, if you talk about branding in education, everyone loses their mind. We already have branding in education. We have KIPP, we have Hillsdale, we have BJU Press in the homeschooling world, we have Yale, right? This is nothing new, but applying it in this context always seems to surprise people for some reason. We have some good evidence to show that parents respond to branding and react when their expectations are not met by attrition. So, again, none of this is new, but it's new in this space because the K-12 education space has been so sort of stagnant since the one-room schoolhouse in the 1800s that talking about branding in the education space is a new thing. Just to highlight here, I think this could take a lot of bite out of sort of our perennial education disputes. You know, what constitutes a good education is something that people cannot agree on. You go back to Aristotle discussing what the purpose of education is and what good education is. I don't think we're going to solve those questions in the public policy stage. And as long as parents are forced into a one-size-all-fits system, those discussions between, for example, college and career preparatory focus versus citizenship, you know, what is the real purpose of education? Those questions have so much bite now because the system we have forces everybody into to accept the same answers, essentially. So I actually think there's a lot of potential here for ESAs to, like, sort of harmonize a lot of different people when they're starting to sell their ideas or promote their ideas to parents directly, and parents who agree with those ideas. You'll see a segmentation of parents going with the brands that sort of align with their educational philosophy, and a lot less acrimony because of that. So the final thing I talk about in my paper is expert consulting or expert review. I think we're going to see the high school guidance counselor evolve a little bit in this new world. I think that there are going to be people who are really familiar with sort of all the providers that are out there, whether that's schools or tutors or educational therapy providers, people who sell curricula, people who sell I think something like lab access to a biology lab to do dissections. There's going to be a whole lot of these guys out there, and I think that parents are going to need help sorting through all of those options to see a, sort of a smaller list to be investigated more thoroughly. And I think that's where hiring somebody with an expertise in this particular market is going to become a popular solution. That's already an acceptable use, at least in some ESA programs. So I don't think it's a big stretch to use a certain percentage, a small percentage of ESA funds, just like a small percentage it can be earmarked for transportation purposes. It can be earmarked for helping parents sort through the options they're going to have. But experts are also going to be able to exercise some kind of quality control via sort of expert review. Here I'm thinking more like the U.S. World News Report, talking about how certain brands or certain education providers, the education that they provide aligns with things like, you know, what kind of nationally normed test scores are they getting? How does it align with college and career preparatory standards or expectations, right? What are your chances of getting into, for example, University of California University, given these providers that you've chosen? I think experts have a real opportunity here to help disseminate that kind of information to parents. And again, I think I think some parents will look to, you know, different sorts of expert confirmation. So, you know, a Mormon parent in Utah may not be looking for the same kind of alignment with the same standards or expectations as a parent in Alabama who, you know, is looking for something that will prepare her child for a great career coming out of sort of what will be called high school, but who knows, because I also think one of the key points about ESAs is it's going to, by necessity, move us to more of a content mastery-based system. So just to wrap up, and then I'll take your questions, I think the revolution is already here. I think we're at the very sort of beginning stage of this revolution, but I think not 10 years from now, but we're talking next year, the year after that, maybe 3 years down the line, we're talking about having millions of students potentially who will be eligible for these completely customizable ESAs. So I think it's kind of behooves us as people who are interested, obviously policymakers, legislators, you know, advocacy groups. It behooves us to start thinking about how parents are going to deal with sorting through these options, and secondarily also how we're going to make sure that to attract the supply side, so that parents have the broadest and highest quality set of options to choose from right out of the gate, and that they don't have to, you know, sort of stumble around for a few years before everybody finds their footing. So I think ALEC is pretty uniquely placed because we have both private and public sector members, because, you know, we're a sort of place where people come to discuss good policy. I think that we're uniquely placed to open up a lot of those conversations, and I hope to be doing that in the next year or two. So now I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question today, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, it is star 1 if you have a question today. We'll pause for just a moment. And I have no questions at this time, but I'd like to remind everyone it's star one if you have a question. And I do have some questions. The first one will come from Alexandra Hudson from Wisconsin for Law and Liberty.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Hi.
Hi, Inez. Thanks so much for speaking to us today. Really, really glad for your new piece, and it's been a really helpful resource to us in Wisconsin here, so thank you. I'm wondering what, in your experience, in your discussions, and in your research, you have found to be the most appealing argument against those who say ESAs are not helpful. What about disengaged parents that tend to be from, you know, low income or certain demographic areas, backgrounds rather? What about the parents that don't have the time, that are too concerned with, you know, putting food on the table, they don't have the time to develop an educational philosophy that ESAs would help them kind of bring to fruition? What do you think is a good way to respond to that kind of rhetorical and quite compelling argument?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we get, and thank you for your question, and thanks for participating in all of this. Yeah, I mean, I think we get that question a lot, just as advocates in general for school choice. So I guess my first answer is, this is why I think these kind of talking about these kind of tools is so important at this stage in the game. To talk about, you know, to remind people that parents do this. They do this in dozens of other capacities in their lives. When they choose, you know, their cars and their restaurants and their, you know, they do this in so many other areas of their lives, and we trust them to do it in all kinds of other areas, and yet it seems so hard for some people to just trust parents to be engaged enough to engage and to use some of these tools, right? And there'll be help out there. Like I said, the sort of guidance, I think there will be consulting and help and guidance counselors and a lot of, you know, websites that help folks sort of sort through a lot of this. So I understand that parents, not all parents are going to spend, you know, hours and hours on this. That's why I think these tools will be so helpful. So that's part of my motivation and starting to talk about this now. But the other thing, I always like to repeat this story that Virginia Waldenford told me when I was working in, actually as an intern, Heritage Foundation, and was helping out with some DCOSP scholarship stuff. And her story, she always talked about this guy who came in to sign up for a scholarship in the District of Columbia. And when he first walked in, it was obvious he was really high. He had, you know, very little idea of where he was. In fact, he was so out of it that they thought he had wandered in by accident, and so security started to escort him out. But, you know, as they sort of tried to escort him out, he said, no, 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 I'm here to sign up for a voucher for my kid. I want a scholarship for my kid. And so they helped him fill out the paperwork and, you know, sort of sent him on his way, and it turns out his kid did get the scholarship. And she met him 3 years or 4 years later, and he was a changed person. He cleaned up his act. He wasn't on drugs anymore. And she asked him why, and he said, you know, my kid was in this new environment where it was clear that I was letting her down. There were expectations of me as a parent in this kind of environment that, you know, I nobody in the public schools had ever cared if I didn't show up to parent-teacher conferences or, you know, whatever. And so I think you'd be really surprised how people engage when they actually have power. Right? It's funny to me that we criticize parents for being disengaged when we don't give them any way out. We don't give them any power over their situation. So it's a little funny to criticize people with no power to send their kids to the kind of education they'd like for not being engaged enough in their kids' education. I think that's sort of, that I find that argument to be really compelling. It comes down to paternalism at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
And I have another question that comes from Claire Mullen from Gleason.
Hi, Claire.
Hi, Inez. Hello. How are you? my question was actually relating to something I read in your report under the funding section. You mention in there that ESA programs could possibly also be funded using tax credit scholarship method instead of the state-funded. I'm wondering, it's the first I've heard of that idea, and I'm wondering if it is being tried anywhere, and do you think that that might actually hurt the design of the ESA? And that, I mean, I would think that the state-funded money that's meant for education that was intended to be used for the ESAs we currently have, I'm concerned that if we get away from that and start using the tax credit dollars, that that will hurt the original design of the ESA. What do you think about that?
So we've got one of the folks who wrote that report on here. I think Jason Bederick is on here, so he probably can answer this even better than I can. So I don't really disagree with your points, actually, but there are states where it is extremely difficult because of the way the Bland Amendments are written to get through state-funded. So this is one of the states I'm thinking about right now is Missouri. So Missouri did introduce one of these tax credit-funded ESAs. So I think there are sort of upsides and downsides to both. The upside of having it funded via tax credit scholarships is that it's, it's 1 degree of separation more even than most school choice programs because it's all private money that never passes through the hands of the state. So there might be legal advantages in certain limited states for that. But on the flip side, there are limitations to how large tax credit programs can get. Florida looks like it's pushing the limitations already. And if we have hope that ESAs are going to really transform the system as opposed to functioning as a ticket out for a minority of students, I think that model may not be ideal for that purpose. And then there's also some program design issues, like how exactly would, and maybe Jason can speak to this if you, like, contact him later, but, like, some program design issues, because if you have multiple SGOs, right, the SGOs want to have, the donors want to have a say in what options are sort of circumscribed by the program. And so I think there are program design issues that to be worked out, but I think that they are a possibility. The reason I mentioned it is because I think there are states where that is what we can, you know, what we can manage to get, and I think it's better than not having a program.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll take our next question from William Maddox from James Madison Institute.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi.
This is great work that you've done. I have a question that picks up in some ways on that first question that was asked about kind of low-income parents and whether or not they'd be able to really pull this off. And I'm curious to know whether any of the Arizona data that has been collected on parental usage shows any sort of split between more affluent and less affluent parents and whether they seek out bundled versus unbundled services. And related to that, I'd be curious to hear your response to this notion, and that is, it seems to me that even parents who would ultimately prefer to just get a bundled package because they don't want to sort through all of the multiplicity of options would nevertheless benefit more in an ESA world because the people doing the bundling would be able to tap into all of these different possibilities that would arise. And so the local private school that they would like to enroll their child in might have online courses or other options that would normally not be available because they were coming from other providers. But now in a ESA world where there are all sorts of different new providers in the system, they would be able to tap into some of those resources and offer them as part of their bundled package rather than simply relying on the courses that they themselves could teach in their classrooms. So anyway, that's kind of the gist of what I'm interested in hearing you respond to.
Yeah, so I think those are both really good questions. I don't know if there is any data on the Arizona program. That's something for me to look up and for some other folks to look into about sort of low income versus middle or higher income. I know that a lot of the customization and the unbundling, so to speak, that's happening in the Arizona program is has to do with sort of special needs and bringing in therapists and individual folks who have experience with that particular challenge to bring and work with the kids at home. That split I'm aware of. I'm not aware of an income split, and I'd be interested to see, although I think the data would be a little skewed because of the high numbers of kids with special needs who are in the program, if that makes sense. Because, like, there are plenty of high-income parents who probably are more inclined to customize because the way these programs have been designed, if you're high income, you are more likely to have gotten onto one of these programs in this initial non-universal programs if your kid has an IEP. So I would think that it's still definitely interesting and worth looking into, but I would think that might skew it a little bit from the researcher's perspective. And then I know that you're working on, for the second part of that, I know you're working on this kind of micro-schooling idea, and I think that that's exactly – I do think that most parents will continue to want one package of educational services. I'm less certain that that package will be what we think of today as a school, if that makes any sense. I know you're working on the idea that parents are almost coming together, combining money, and sort of coming up with a vision for their own, what they want their micro school to look like, and then hiring tutors, calculus tutors, right, or English literature professors to come in on, Friday at 8 p.m. when they're not working, their traditional jobs, and come and teach students in those kinds of non-traditional, quote-unquote, schools, right? So I do think bundling is going to continue to be a big thing, which is why I think branding and this sort of guidance counselor type stuff is going to be so important. I think parents are going to want, the vast majority of parents are not going to go line by line, course by course, and review providers for every single one of those and decide which one's best. They're going to go with a bundled package. I would be excited to see how that bundled package of education moves from the traditional school into something that itself is more customized.
That's great. Very good. Thank you.
Well, unless we have any other I just got – thank you, Lindsay. We don't have data on low income versus higher income in Arizona, apparently, but maybe that's something for some aspiring researchers on this call to look into. So if you have any more questions, I don't know if anyone has any more questions, or other than that, we're actually 1 minute over. So if there are no other questions, I'd just like to thank you guys so much for being on this call, and I look forward to feel free to email me, ifelcher, ifelcher at alec.org, with any other questions or any comments or disagreements. I'd love to hear from you. So thanks for being on today.
And that does conclude our conference call today. Thank you all for your participation.